Talk number 5 by Geoffrey Hodson, given at Crotona, Ohio, on October the 15th, 1977, entitled The Ever Open Pathway to Discipleship, Initiation, and Adeptship.
Mr. Layton and fellow students, as in my earlier talks, I have been describing the procedures of the call to discipleship and its acceptance, chiefly from biblical sources. And so we might permissibly ask ourselves whether these self-same privileges received so long ago are possibly available in modern days. Well, as my title indicates, theosophy affirms very positively in the affirmative, even if the meetings with the Master may not always be physical at first. Now, this morning, as we study these teachings together, purely for your considerations, let me advance some of the basic ideas. First, a wise teacher, more advanced than oneself as a source of knowledge, almost always appears in the life of a truly ardent and selfless aspirant towards discipleship. Thereafter follow the developments in the aspirant and the events which this morning I'm going to offer for your consideration. We are going to see if we can, how you and I could follow Peter, James, John, and Andrew, and others to the feet of a master and become disciples, answering the call, follow me and I will make you to become fishers of men. The great call. And this is the subject of our study together this morning. A continuation, really, of last Saturday's address, when we considered the age-old teaching concerning the actual existence on the earth of a hierarchy of perfected men and women. Of course, as Christians, we are by no means unfamiliar with the concept and even actual possibility that every human being is undergoing an evolutionary development which will culminate in perfection, Christhood, adeptship. May I repeat what I quoted from St. Paul in this respect? In Ephesians 4:13, St. Paul affirms, until we all come in the unity of the faith and in the knowledge of the Son of God unto a perfect man, unto the measure of the stature of the fullness of Christ. And you remember, our Lord himself affirmed, ye shall be perfect, even as your Father which is in heaven is perfect. Matthew 5:48, the Revised Version. And so, with reference to our particular subject, we follow on that definite statement to a study of the way in which we as human beings would need to order our lives, if not having already done so, in order first to hear that wondrous call and, if so moved, affirmatively to answer it. Well, friends, here we are in the world, living out our lives in the world, and we are going closely to consider both the possibility of direct knowledge of perfect men, adepts, and the possibility, nay, certainty, may I say, of hearing his voice calling directly to us, as I have just quoted. Supposing that happened to us in response to our sincere and selfless aspirations, what then would the necessities be? What actual guidance would be present? And what kind of teaching would we then receive? How may we prepare and direct our thinking, our habits of life, and our purposes for living so that the wondrous voice may be not only heard, but that standing in his presence, we may answer his call, even while still fulfilling our duties out in the world. Well, theosophy has a very great deal of advice to offer us. It teaches us that this self-same call by one having authority may be heard today. And for those so moved, may affirmatively be answered, and the spiritual way of life, the path of discipleship, may be embarked upon. Our subject really this morning. Well, there is, of course, as we know well, the more or less secret contemplative life, the religious orders, the convents and the monasteries, and all the opportunities for retiring from the world and therein devoting ourselves to spirituality. But whether in retreat or out in the world, certain rules must be obeyed, certain developments occur within us, in our hearts, in our minds, and, yes, in our daily lives. What are these? Well, that spirituality actually consists in discovering and becoming one's higher, nobler self, in always accentuating the highest in motive, in speech, and in mode of life. Indeed, we might say that the discovery of one's highest self is both the immediate and the main and true purpose of all spiritual exercises. What then must we do actually? Well, apparently there are two primary essentials. First, a kind of, the way it's put, a kind of robust common sense based upon an appreciation of spiritual values and culminating in an intuitive and unshakable conviction in the mind that the eternal Godhead alone is the reality and that all other things are illusory. And therefore, the mind, the heart, the prayers, the meditations are all directed towards the discovery of this eternal reality upon which the universe is built. The second necessity, they tell us, is a wise discrimination, especially between that which is unreal or transitory and that which is real or permanent. We must not, for example, make of ourselves penniless objects of charity in pursuit of the ideal of spirituality, but in a common sense way, adjust our thinking and living according to the new and great ideal. For example, stewardship, or wisely holding one's wealth and one's possessions on behalf of others, as well, of course, as for one's own necessities. This is one example of discrimination concerning possessions. And this is or may be regarded as the most important personal application of the ideal of spirituality. Good sense. Common sense, viveka, wise discrimination. Spiritual awakening may make this difficult because interior experiences may come, change the mind, change the attitude towards life and people, and may for a time make us less than wise, foolish even for a time. But eventually, this wisdom, this approach, this spiritual awakening becomes as natural, yes, as natural in the individual as the awakening in the plant of the bud and then the flower. All a perfectly natural unfoldment from within one, of the ideal, to the heights, to the master, to discipleship, still to be obtained whilst wisely fulfilling all our duties here in the world. Yes, the thought comes to me then, whilst one is thus handling the situation, might I say, one's friends might hardly notice the change. Only later, as it becomes fulfilled, may this become apparent. But at a certain stage of evolution, there naturally occurs an interior awakening to attain. Our presence here together in these numbers and audiences throughout the world to listen to this subject indicate that this awakening, this stage of evolution is indeed being entered upon today by a very large number of people. Unfortunately, though some guidance exists, not sufficient wise guidance is available for us all. For when certain phases of evolution are entered upon, the interior self, the self-shining pure being, the monad, begins to take hold of one's life. It becomes powerful enough within one to send spiritualizing influences into us here as we live our lives as personalities, as men and women in the world. And these interior awakenings, these strange, quite natural buddings, eventual flowerings, they strengthen the conscience. They arouse the aspiration to make the very most of life and to living accordingly as to the very highest purity, service for others. And when this stage is reached, the interior awakening, the inner self speaks, begins to take hold of mind, heart. Life follows then, as it has been said, there is no other path at all to go. Then one experiences what the disciples must have felt when they heard the call, not only outwardly, but inwardly as well. Straightway, they left their nets and followed him. Now, shall we ourselves follow aspirants on into the new and wonderful inner life? We find at once that three experiences will be passed through. First, mentally awakened man seeks the answers to the problems of life. He or she wants, yes, common sense in religion, logic. He wants justice from the divine source. And he experiences, or she, a deepening interest in philosophy, in religion, and the combination of both. Then, when that happens, the great search begins. The search for knowledge, which, by the by, may be hastened by painful experiences, perhaps loss of trust in orthodox religion. There may come worldly failure. There may come bereavement, frustration, even disaster. And these rightly received, rightly responded to, can move us towards the real search for truth. And then the neophyte also experiences an interior of wakening of will and what has been called a divine discontent, becomes aware of the apparent uselessness of so much in life and experiences what has been described as the inexpressible longing of the inner man for the infinite. This, friends, this interior experience is all important, we are told. And so it's born naturally in people. Dissatisfaction, self-shame, the sense of failure, even amidst material success. All these may act as spurs in this direction. The individual recognizes that selfishness and materialism have ruled his or her life. And they see how harmful these are. And, of course, yes, how hurtful he or she has been to others. If facing up to oneself, one sees that one has been drifting, that indeed purposelessness has been the cause of much of the suffering and the failure in life. And then one can note, as doubtless many of you have done, that the faculties remain undeveloped, that indulgences have not been outgrown, and we see a certain smallness of aim in life. That wakes you up. And eventually there come a time when you are determined to rise above all these and all other faults. I mention this as a kind of introduction to our subject according to the title, because without these, then, the call is not likely to be heard. But something wonderful always happens. So it is taught when we reach this stage, kind of divine dissatisfaction. Something wonderful happens. What is it? Well, it is taught that at this stage, wonderfully, help becomes available. The aspirant meets a wise friend who becomes a teacher, whether interiorly, externally, or both. This is greatly stressed in Buddhism. The value and the advantage of having a good friend. A good friend is indeed regarded as an indispensable factor in this procedure of hastened evolution to discipleship and thereon to adeptship. And so, look out. The possession of a helper, a wise friend, is indeed a great blessing. Yes, the thought comes to me there. In due course, if successful, one may perhaps play that beautiful and wonderful part. A wise friend to the seekers for light, truth, and beauty and unfoldment in this world of ours. Then, following upon interior awakening and divine discontent, a third experience accompanies the true arousal of the soul. What is it? Well, they say that it consists of a diminution of the sense of separateness from others. An increase in the realization of kinship. We really are all members of one family. And that there's one and the same life in each and every one of us. A sense of responsibility, of course, follows. There's a change from getting only to giving. A change from action upon the personal to the impersonal, from the smaller to the larger self. And all this, friends, goes on, apparently, inside the individual. Again, I say, as naturally as the bud appears, and the bud slowly opens to the flower and eventually the fruit. So this same wondrous process of nature is taking place in every human being. And we're all of us, yes, at some stage along that wonderful procedure of life. Evolution, if you like, unfoldment to ever higher states. Yes, I want to say there, the only real purpose for our existence. Too far? No, I think not. The real purpose for our existence is unfoldment to ever greater and greater spiritual, intellectual heights with added capacities. Yes, I want to say something else. Profound belief that's grown in me, if I may share it. When once a person realizes that unfoldment is the one supreme purpose of the existence of universe, its contents, and so human beings, when once it is realized that unfoldment is the purpose of existence, then the intelligent individual collaborates. I can't, and I don't know words enough to make that clear enough or sufficiently important. I have come to believe, and I share my belief with you, this concept of ascent, as it is called, consent with the divine plan, and increasingly participating in its fulfillment. The best way I can put it, willing ascent is extremely important in ordinary life, but especially when the path of discipleship is being approached. Anything else? Well, yes, one other qualification must be made. What is that? Well, that the means of livelihood, please listen, this is so important, the means of livelihood must be neither ignoble nor what? Nor hurtful to others. Oh, my word. What a barrier. What a change that's going to be called for in the lives of so very large a number of human beings. The means of livelihood, I repeat, must be neither ignoble nor hurtful to others, whether animals or men, for the path of discipleship successfully to be followed. On the contrary, indeed, compassion assumes an increasing place in motive, thought, word, deed, yet even glance of the eye. And this must apply to home life, to all life in which ahimsa or harmlessness becomes totally incarnate within one. And one would never harm another or voluntarily produce pain in another, especially for personal gain. I know that's not very welcome, but I was in justice and in a proper presentation of our ideal. I must advance this idea of what in Sanskrit is called ahimsa, meaning not hurt me, held very high amongst all the oriental aspirants. And then there's a further idea that the practice of the spiritual life is a science, an ordered, carefully organized effort is essential to success. This means for you and for me, our daily life, which must, for example, yes, I ought to say this too, our daily lives ought to conceive to include regular meditation or prayer. Meditation based on the fact that all which man is seeking is within him, is part of his or her inner life. And this inner divinity must be found. And meditation is the way. And to accomplish this, regulation of effort is necessary. Privacy is necessary. The right posture of the body is necessary. And the turning of the mind correctly to the divine. All these are helpful in the attainment of that inner illumination for which meditation is designed. Meditation implies, doesn't it, the daily withdrawal of thought from the transient to the eternal, a deepening interest in those things which are unchanging, undying, everlasting. And the mind is turned increasingly from mortality to immortality, from the many to the one, and so from ignorance to divine truth. Not heard from someone else, friend, as I'm endeavoring to think with you, but growing from within, until at last you know there is one life in all, and that all is proceeding towards the one goal, and that, above all things, you must help and never, even by a fragment of pain, voluntarily hurt another. Especially, yes, I must add, especially for purposes of self-gain. And as a result of regular meditation, aspirants gradually come to know themselves as radiant, immortal, divine beings, flame-lit, shall I say, part of the fire which is God. That is the goal of meditation. Then and now we are coming towards our subject, discipleship, and the actual meeting with the Master. It does, upon it, does depend a very definite change of point of view concerning one's position in the world, one's activities, and the underlying motives for them. The doctor, for example, if he wants to become a disciple, may regard himself as a channel for the healing life of God and of the Master-to-be. He stresses preventative medicine, seeks to eliminate the causes for the disease. The teacher is as dedicated as a priest, serving especially the God within the child to draw out the innate faculties. The government official endeavors to establish the ideal administration. The lawyer wants to become a personal counselor. And all work comes to be regarded as part of the one work and carried out on behalf of the one worker of all, the great Lord of the universe. Too far-fetched? Too far away? No, not if you meditate regularly. For as a result of those times of quiet, day by day if you can, quarter of an hour if you can, as a result of those times of quiet contemplation of the divine in silence, gradually there dawns in the consciousness the realization of this oneness with God and through Him with all that lives. Am I not coming to my subject yet? Oh, I'm right in it now. For believe me, all this is part of the training. If one is to meet the necessities of evolutionary position, which will bring one to hear that divine voice, then at last, and now we've come to that point in our studies, then at the appointed time, ask me, if you like, in question time, what I mean by the appointed time. Marvelously important concept. I mustn't say now, but I'll repeat. At granted a measure of progress, reasonable, and to the best of our ability in these directions, the Master, remember, having been watching all the time, aware of the inner aspiration, then follows the meeting between master and pupil, whether directly, physically, if the master is in the neighborhood, or if he temporarily materializes his form and appears to be in the with you as he can, or by calling the pupil to him in the superphysical body, whilst the physical body sleeps. So I'm going to repeat that. The appointed time of the meeting between master and pupil comes eventually, directly and physically, if the master is in the neighborhood, or in a temporally materialized form for this very purpose, or by calling the pupil to him in the superphysical body, whilst the physical body sleeps. That's one description of how the meeting may occur. At the request of the master, one of his disciples, already accepted, may conduct the aspirant in his superphysical vehicles to the master's home. Or the master himself may call the awakened person into his presence. And a great journey is then made. And after the body has fallen asleep, the inner self in the subtler bodies goes even right across the world into the ashram or home wherein the great master abides. This experience of being in the master's presence remains forever unforgettable. The neophyte finds himself or herself fully conscious in the superphysical body and in the presence of a superhuman being of quite remarkable appearance. For remember, the adept has attained to every perfection, both of feature and of form. His countenance is stamped with the impress of power and of profundity of thought. The eyes are large and alight with an inner fire, their gaze being all penetrating. Yes, but ever kindly and wise. They are the eyes of an infallible seer and judge. Yet they are filled with friendliness, with compassion, and, of course, with full understanding of all that the presence of the would-be pupil with him implies. For when a master looks at a man, he knows all he needs to know of that man's past, present, and future. It's not, friends, just like meeting another very wise human being alone. The master's consciousness is established in his highest nature, so that when he sees a would-be disciple or anyone else, he can at will know the whole past, past lives, the past, present, and even knowing something of the potential future. I presume future usefulness in the great cause of the enlightenment of the human mind. Yes, since he is a master, he sees all and he comprehends all. The aspirant knows this and is so unafraid, even as awe-inspired and exalted he stands in the presence of his master-to-be. He sees in that master power, quite irresistible, wisdom all-inclusive, detachment and serenity that can never be disturbed. He's then questioned. I'm using the masculine. It applies equally to both sexes. He is then questioned as to his willingness to essay what is called the razor-edged path. He is told that if he agrees, he will be called upon to take his further evolution definitely into his own hands with the master's aid. Then the ideal is put before him or her, eventually to subdue all earthly desires, humbly to face faults and eliminate them. He's encouraged and helped to annihilate self-will and to undergo and endure to the very end all the ordeals and tests which may be inseparable from the future treading of the path of hastened evolutionary development. It is a hastened path, you see, and therefore it is not inevitably without such tests and strains and, yes, even increase of difficulties in the outer life. But all the time, the inner life is being filled with happiness, with unfolding light and life, all born of the knowledge that the Master exists, has been met, and is willing to receive him at least on probation, as a pupil under his direction. He's inspired with his master's ever available and most kind help. He's inspired to work continually at herself or himself to try and improve the character. And without thought of reward, selflessly to serve the world as all predecessors, all previous pupils have done. He thus receives the ancient and unchanging God. Follow me, and I will make you to become fishers of men. What may we suppose, friends, fishers of men meant? Fishing, angling, seeking others similarly awake and helping them on the pathway to the same glorious goal. So I suggest. Even then, interesting point. The neophyte is left with a certain freedom. He's called, or she, informed of the necessities, promised the necessary aid, but left free. If, however, the neophyte assents to the master's call, and in his presence he almost certainly will, then he is received officially as a pupil on probation, a full disciple to be. As I said that, excuse me if I have this way of wandering a little, but then the biblical story came to my mind. You remember it? A very rich young lawyer came to our Lord Jesus Christ and said, Master, please tell me how I may attain to eternal life. And the Master, knowing all doubtless, said, keep the commandments. You know them, keep them. He once responded, all this I have done from my youth up, tell me more. And the Master, then came the acid test, remember? Sell all that thou hast. Give to the poor. Take up thy cross and follow me. And then, yes, I just come to my mind, there comes one of the saddest verses in the Bible, I often think. Take up thy cross and follow me. What happened? And he turned sorrowfully away, for he was of great possession. Oh, the opportunity will recur. The Master will never forget him. And in due course, a little further on in his evolution, he will find himself again in that glorious presence and doubtless will answer fully as he should. However, when once acceptance has been received, then a veritable new phase of human evolution is entered upon. From then on, the pupil increasingly directs and quickens his or her own progress and, yes, becomes more and more fully in charge of life. If it has been out of the body, well then, of course, there's a return to the body in the morning, after the first and even subsequent meeting. At first, the pupil may not remember or wholly remember, but eventually the great event and its successors become part of his or her inner life. Their great upliftment deeply impresses and wholly affects the whole experience and motives for living and way of life of the individual to whom this great, yes, and still possible privilege has been granted. His soul and his mind brain will, in consequence, seem to be aflame sometimes when he meditates. A new fire will burn within him, the fire of an irrevocable resolve. Nevermore into the weaknesses and cruelties of that past, onwards into the strength and love and compassion and tenderness for all that lives, which will replace the cruelty. Yes, yes, that second is necessary, friend. For many weeks after that first experience, the pupil may move exalted, as if within a golden light. And the master's face, his eyes, his smile, his majesty, and his love may live within the pupil's heart and mind. If it has been in the master's home, well, then the room, the house and the room wherein the meeting occurred will be remembered and often entered thereafter. And the master's words and guidance will often be given. And the master will watch and heal and help and above all use the pupil as a channel for his healing and helpful grace and illumination as he or she meets with others under the great aspiration to serve. He or she, I understand, is not even then entirely alone. Generally, the master instructs a senior disciple living in the outer world to keep a watch on the new pupil, guide and assist the neophyte, and give the necessary information about the application of the new ideals to life. There, my time has gone as far as discipleship is concerned. And so in conclusion, for this particular part of our time together, may I share the ideal that this way of life is open to all who have the vision to perceive it, the aspiration to enter upon it, and the courage to tread it to the end. And the way a selfless love for all that lives must and does become the great driving force for the remainder of that individual's existence. Thus move, friends, thus living. It becomes true. In answer to my title, yes. It is still possible today to see the Master not only along the lake shores, field paths, and village streets of Judea alone, long before that. And always, and so now, it's still possible, just the same, to hear, to see him, to meet him, to have him approach, and to hear his call, follow me and I will make you fishers or servants of men. And if the heart is ready to answer, yes, Master, take me. Thank you.
Mr. Hodson continues his talk and then answers questions.
Friend, although I spent most of our time together on the subject of discipleship, I have brought some material concerning the later stages and will now share it with you. There are what are called officially, I understand, steps on the path. And there appear to be many which follow that first acceptance into pupilhood. Eventually, it is taught, and you will find this in our books, as I have done, the disciple is eventually presented by his master to his brother adepts, the members of the great hierarchy of the adepts of whom we studied last Saturday. That presentation is in preparation and eventual for and eventual reception of the great privilege, it is said, of the rite of initiation, as it is called. If the disciple, presumably, is found to be properly prepared, then the ceremony of initiation is performed by one or other of the great adepts under the assent of the great senior of all upon our globe. When it is performed, buddhic or Christ consciousness is said to be entered, and the initiate is admitted to membership of the great brotherhood of the adepts of this our earth. Not as an adept, but as one on the pathway thereto. At the first great initiation, so one learns, as at each of its successors, an occult ceremonial is enacted by the adepts, bringing about a descent of the innermost self of the initiate into his spiritual self and thereafter into his or her personal consciousness and life. This, of course, this admission to membership of that great brotherhood, when granted, brings with it, one assumes, increasing responsibility for helping forward the evolution of the life and form upon this planet. Christ consciousness, as I've said, is born, in quotes, is born at this nativity of the soul, bestowing a deepening sense of oneness with the life in all beings and in every aspect of nature. For then the great truth is realized that indeed all life is one. And I might go back to my earlier remarks and say that this realization is the true goal of all meditative practices. As one description puts it, to be dissolved in the one life of the universe, like water in water, space in space, light in light. Wonderful experience it must be, the goal of the meditative practice and life, aided tremendously by this wonderful privilege of initiation in the presence of the great brotherhood of Earth's adept. Ultimately, of course, presumably after many lives, the goal of adeptship itself is attained. The object has been gained. I was pausing then, if you'll excuse me, whether I should describe that condition to you as revealed by the Lord Buddha and translated into beautiful English verse by Sir Edwin Arnold in his book, The Light of Asia. There he describes this last attainment. I haven't got the notes with me, but I dwell on it. I think I know it by heart. Something like this. Excuse me if I stumble. No more to live as ye name life. No more has he to live as ye name life. That which began in him when he began is finished. He hath wrought the purpose through of what did make him man. Never shall yearnings torture him, nor sins stain him, nor ache of earthly joys and woes invade his safe eternal peace, nor lives or deaths recur. He goes unto nirvana. He is one with life, yet lives not. He is blessed, ceasing to be. Om Mani Padme Om. The dewdrop slips into the shining sea. Lord Buddha's description of adeptship and beyond. Now, last friends, before I attempt to answer your many questions, I brought a quotation here from a letter which a master wrote to an inquirer who was privileged to have come into literary association with him. And the master wrote back. The writer was in Simla or Allahabad in India, and the master in northern Tibet. And in one of his letters, the master, evidently answering a question as to whether the master knew when a letter was coming or of the writer's thought, because the master writes very beautifully like this. I'm quoting, "Like the light in the somber valley seen by the mountaineer from his peaks, every bright thought in your mind, my brother, will sparkle and attract the attention of your distant friend and correspondent. It is thus we discover our allies in the shadow world, your world, and ours outside the precincts. And it is our law to approach every such as one, if even there be but the feeblest glimmer of the true Buddha light within him. Thus, how easy it is for you to attract our attention." Well, that, of course, that was beautifully said also by someone whose name I cannot find. So I quote anonymously. "If, therefore, ye are intent upon wisdom, a lamp will not be wanting, and a shepherd will not fail, and a fountain will not dry up." Or in other words, I presume, no one sincerely seeking the light and the Master, no one is ever overlooked or fails to receive help of the most wisely planned type. And I close with a quotation from a wonderful book, another wonderful book, The Voice of the Silence by H.P. Blavatsky. If you're interested, that's one of the very best books in existence, I believe. Well, here are three or four lines only. The light from the one Master, the one unfading golden light of spirit, shoots its effulgent beams upon the disciple from the very first. Its rays thread through the thick, dark clouds of matter. Again, no one is ever overlooked. And if we seek, then we will find the great Master, and we are advised to think of him, to remember him, to be ever open to him, to invoke his aid in all services which are rendered to others and to the world. In other words, I suppose, if this ideal has really taken up its abode in the heart and mind of hearing that voice calling to the disciple, then live with it. And rest assured, your cry, our cry, will never be unanswered. The answer will always come, and in the most wise form, suited to us, our temperament, our attitude of mind, and our ways of life. And I close again by those wonderful words, no one is ever overlooked. May one employ his innate faculties in conjunction with a divining rod or pendulum for subjective or objective purposes, such as occult, medical, communication with the higher self, business, demonstrations of unknown powers. Well, to all of these inquiries, an old proverbial saying comes to my mind. I'm rather factual in my attitude to everything occult. Very much so, perhaps too much so. And so I can only say what I say to myself. The proof of the pudding is in the eating. If it works, test it scientifically. Always. Test everything scientifically. If it works in accordance with science and is an objective proven fact, record it and continue the investigations until at last you've arrived at your own conclusions in this matter. More than that, I'm afraid I can't say. Oh, I've met with and seen people working in all of these and know that the powers do exist. Yes, yes. But as to whether a single individual and our friend here knows, then test it like you would test any other scientific experiment. Thank you. Very well. See me after. Oh, I can't comment. Excuse me. Is homosexuality part of evolution? I don't know. I have no knowledge on the subject. Excuse me. Would you talk a little on life after death? I shall be doing so on Sunday week, I think it is, for the Northern Southern Federation. Is that public or the members? No.
Next week, and that is a meeting for members, and Jeffrey says he will be talking on that subject then. And also, thank you, as next Saturday,
I shall be talking upon clairvoyant research. I will include then in that subject, I will include in answer to your question something of the use of clairvoyant research into life after death. I'll do that, friend, in an endeavor to meet your request. Will you remind me, please? Is it possible that we could have this experience without remembering it? Very, very possible. The people, it's according to temperament and psychological condition and health, and what would be best for us in our contact with life as karma has brought it to us. All of those considerations come into play, and it may very well be that the person may not remember. Can you tell a case of a master visiting a pupil in the becoming? Yes, I can. More than one. Have to be brief, won't I? The co-founder of our Theosophical Society, Colonel H.S. Olcott, was collaborating with H.P. Blavatsky, his fellow founder, in the writing of the book Isis Unveiled, Adept Inspired, so it is thought. They'd worked until about 2 o'clock in the morning, he writes. Then he went to his room. Before getting into bed, he sat down beside his bed to read a little. And he says that suddenly a light shone forth in the corner of his room. And he looked up, and to his astonishment, out of that light there stepped the fully formed figure of a very great adept, his master-to-be. And in his account of it, and by the by, he was a colonel in the American Army and a lawyer, so he's not likely to have been imagining it. He says in his article, he was so grand a man that I went down on my knees before him, and with his kind voice, he bid me rise, and we sat and talked. They had a very long talk about what was then far in the future, the possible work that we are now doing here now, the spreading of theosophy throughout the world through a society. And at the end of his account, may interest you, the lawyer in him came up. And in his mind there occurred the thought, I wonder if this is reality, or whether I am in some way being psychologized. The master read his thought, smiled, unwound his beautiful turban, and laid it on the table beside the colonel, saluted, vanished. And the colonel picked up there, in proof that it was a solid visitation, was that turban. And if I may say so, that turban is now in the archives of the Theosophical Society at its international headquarters in Adyar. And anyone who visits is allowed to see it. I myself have handled it many times. And one of the times I was doing so, I looked it over with reverence, of course. And in one corner, I found embroidered the initial name of that great master. So there, you see, was the case. I could tell you many, but one other. This is so interesting, isn't it? One of our members was an American lady and quite famous opera singer. Then suddenly had something went wrong with her voice, and her whole career crumbled, lost her voice. And other things happened, I believe, so much so that she felt she could not continue in life. It was too much. The various sorrows and disappointments were beyond human endurance. So she decided to commit suicide. And there was a very steep cliff in a tree of fir trees, and a very, very steep cliff with rocks far below. And she decided the best way, the quickest way, would be to throw herself over this cliff and have done with her life. She could no longer endure. And she walked to the edge of the cliff. Something pulled her up at the last minute, and she cried out physically, "Master, Master!" Like that, she told me. I've had this personally from her and in writing. I know it's true. And something happened. A whole consciousness changed. The sense of failure and of hopelessness vanished. A new hope came, and she turned round and returned to life and found a wonderful career, very largely in the service of this society. Well, to answer your question, eventually, she was called to Adyar, our headquarters, to help there in many ways, one of which was caring for Colonel Alcott when he was dying. And this I have in writing, and I heard from her personally. She was sitting beside the bed, the Colonel's bed. I think may have been taking a letter or something. He was near the end. And as happened more than once in those days, two very great adepts walked into the room. One on either side of the bed they stood and conversed with Colonel Alcott. And she said to me, "Jeffrey," I immediately went down on my knees just by the master, one of the masters. And she said, "I also thought, is this real?" And I took the liberty of putting my hand out and touching his garment. He felt her, she says, and he turned round at once. He said these words, "Yes, it is I myself. I heard your cry beneath the pines." There you see. No one is overlooked. The master, although he himself will have been in Tibet, heard her cry, here in fact in California. So, yes, friends, I am able to answer in the affirmative. Mr. Hodgson's books dealing with this subject are Thus Have I Heard, The Pathway to Perfection, The Christ Life, From Nativity to Ascension, and The Call to the Heights. Would you comment on the value to an aspirant of developing a childlike meaning non-judgment? Yes? Thank you.
Non-judgmental, unquestioningly living, etc., approach to exploring life.
Did you hear that? Would you, all right, I will repeat, thank you. Would you comment on the value to an aspirant of the development of a childlike meaning, non-argumentative, she means, he or she means, approach to experience of... Yes, to the experiencing, I suppose, to experiencing life. Careful, friend, careful. Yes and no. But this is one of those cases where it's not safe to generalize, not at all. Have to have the individual. And I'm sorry, I can't undertake on this visit such interviews. Ask some of our members here, they'll be able to advise you. I'm afraid I can't. Be careful and use wisdom in this matter. You know, you've got to be matter of fact, you know, in all this which I endeavored to put before you. Though it may have sounded very lofty, nevertheless, it has a base, must have a basis of common sense, of real, factual common sense. And so in any such investigations and approaches, be careful. There's nothing in place of what they call in Sanskrit yoga, vairagya. Robust common sense. You can't beat it, friends. And the more abstract the subject you're dealing with, in a way, the greater the need for vairagya or common sense. What is the effect on an aspirant living in the city amid strong sensual impulses? It depends upon the person again. I can't answer these general questions. I must have the case in front of me, like any doctor. I'm sorry, then. What might be true or not true for you wouldn't be true for another person, do you see? It's unsafe to generalize on such important matters. But a general kind of answer I might offer within my very limited understanding, which is, again by meditation, constantly keep the thought on the highest and most divine subject you can, and practice the transmutation of the sex impulse into intellectual creativity. And there use it. And you'll find that it'll get used up there, and then the physical desire will weaken and weaken, eventually be entirely overcome. Can be. Visualize the creative energy at the base of the spine, shooting rapidly up the head, up the spine, out of the top of the head, as free into the life of the universe. Hold it there. Physical desire will almost immediately pass away. Then watch the thoughts. Careful. Don't allow the thoughts. If you're trying to do that and then you allow your thoughts to dwell on sexual subjects, well then, of course, one will counterbalance the other. But those are mere general remarks. The best I can do for you, friend, and my sympathy. When one sees a figure, knows who it is, although there is no head, hands, or feet, is this because one has not unfolded enough, spiritual enough? In the main, yes, and hasn't developed the faculty. You see, friend, the faculty of clairvoyance is no different from the faculty of hearing or seeing, in the sense that it's got to be tested and used if it's going to be of any value. You've got to find out if you're really seeing correctly. If you want to evaluate your powers of sight, just the same clairvoyance. Evaluate it against scientific facts. See? That's the proper thing to do. Example, very well then, take a electric wire connected to the mains. Switch it on. Can you see any radiation flying from it? Any change in the wire? Any phenomena around it? Right. Now get someone to switch it off without telling you. Can you tell? Then get them to switch it on again. Can you see it? And so on. In other words, apply ordinary, common-sense, scientific means of research. Then you will save yourself from self-deception and open the way into perhaps higher consciousness. But be careful. A number of popular occultists are now saying that the masters have closed up their Tibetan operations and moved to the Andes. Is there any basis for this statement? As far as I know, none whatever. None whatever. But then, here again, each person has to make their own investigations and their own research. All I can say to you is, as far as my very limited understanding goes, no, not so. Does a judge of the judicial process incur a bad karma through his pronouncements of incarceration? No, not if he, his judgments are exact and right, and above all, impersonally in accordance with abstract law and concrete law. If impersonally, building up all the evidence, examining it impersonally, and coming to the obvious conclusion, and then pronouncing it, however harmful to the subject, he's not generating adverse karma. And may I say here, excuse me being so positive, I oughtn't to have been, but may I say here, that with regard to the operation of the law of cause and effect, motive is nearly everything. The motive is extraordinarily important. The motive there, you see, is for the fulfillment of the law of justice and the protection of the inhabitants. Therefore, the motive is good, fine. And as long as that is impersonal, the motive, and the judgment is arrived at impersonally, without favoritism, then the act is good, favorable karma. You know, they came floating into my mind then. The way His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, describes karma. Every deliberate action performed by a self-conscious human being is always followed by an exactly appropriate reaction. Every deliberate action performed by a self-conscious human being is inevitably followed by an exactly appropriate reaction. So here, exactly appropriate. Well, the motive is good, splendid. With every profound respect to His Holiness, the Dalai Lama, for whom I do have the most profound respect, having met him, been blessed by him, with Sandra. Nevertheless, I find myself adding to that wonderful step. It's a presumption that I'll do it, because I feel it ought to be so. So, like this, every deliberate action performed by a self-conscious human being is inevitably followed by an exactly appropriate reaction. Well, I can't help saying, modified by intervening conduct. Anders says, give an example. Well, supposing you've done something ignoble, shall we say, the karma from which would be hurtful, but then you do all you can to make up. Perhaps swell down and running over, then of course that intermediate, that successive conduct would modify the oncoming pattern. and the other. I think it's necessary to go that far.